This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Who are the strongest women you know? Well, for pure strength, odds are athletes like Serena Williams or Ronda Rousey come to mind. But if ever Serena and Ronda had the chance to go up against a prehistoric woman from Central Europe, our Neolithic contestant could have given these modern athletes a run for their money. In a new study out this week in the journal Science Advances, researchers say that by examining the humerus bone of prehistoric women, they have concluded that prehistoric women wielded the upper arm strength of today's elite athletes. So how did these women get so yoked? Well, with me to explain is my guest, Sabrina Agarwal, Associate Professor of Anthropology, University of California, Berkeley. And just a note, she was not involved with the research, but she's certainly familiar with it. Dr. Agarwal, welcome to Science Friday.
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me.
So who were these women, and how would they have gotten so strong that they're, if they were alive today, they could have beaten or matched our modern athletes?
So this study looked at women, they looked at human remains, they looked at the upper bones and the lower bones of the arms and limbs that were excavated from cemeteries all the way from the Neolithic, so like 5,000 years ago BC, to the medieval period, so about 800 years ago, so about 7,000 years of time, all from Central Europe. So they were excavated from these different cemeteries. And they would have looked at their, they looked at their bones, looking at them with what's called CT scans. And while we can't tell exactly what activities they would have been doing, what it did show from the study is that they were certainly doing very demanding manual labor that was repetitive and for long periods of time. And so these women looked even bigger than modern rowing women and elite athletes in terms of how big their upper arm humerus bones were. So the types of activities we know they probably were doing were things that were related to food production. The study notes things like grinding, but also things in the field like plowing, tilling, harvesting, livestock, all those types of activities. So we don't always know exactly what, but we certainly know that it would have been something they did for long periods of time over their life course.
Now, I know you're a biological anthropologist, and that means in English that somebody who studies the morphology of ancient bones.
That's right.
And I want to know how you can tell from the bones why these women were so strong.
Well, skeletons and bones are really cool. We often think of them as being kind of these dried up things that we see in Halloween shops and things like that. But during life, the skeleton is actually a really dynamic tissue. It's like it's an organ. It behaves like an organ. And during life, your bones change their shape, they change their size, depending on things that you do and your diet and different types of activities. And certain bones, particularly the ones in the limbs, the arms and the legs, have a very direct relationship with mechanical loading and activity. And so if you do a lot of activity, you get bigger muscles, and the bigger muscles make stronger bones and change the shape of the bones. And so we can kind of indirectly study that the size and shape reflects the amount of activity that someone would have had. So it's recorded in the skeleton long after death in ancient skeletons from all over the place.
It's quite interesting. I mean, so why are we only now, after all these years as anthropologists, finding out how strong these women were?
Well, I think part of it is that there's an kind of persistent bias that we think of with males being the ones that traditionally did all of the manual work and all of the provisioning in early societies. And this idea goes back to even how we think about humans at the dawn of human origins, modern Homo sapiens. We often thought that modern humans maybe even started to walk and be bipedal because they needed to go and provide food for the females. It's actually called the male provisioning theory. And I think that these types of bias, that it's males that did all of the manual work and females that basically stayed back and had lots of children, persist all the way into what we think about happening at the transition to agriculture. And so this idea that males are the ones that are doing all of the major contributions was kind of the assumption that was held even when we started to look at this period of the transition. We assumed that the women were staying at home and having babies, and so to some extent no one really thought about looking at the females directly.
Interesting. Do you have the same kind of growth in upper arm strength around men at this time too?
Well, this particular study didn't compare directly the humerus of the males to the females. What they did find is that males over long periods of time, over this period of 7,000 years, tend to continue to have really robust lower limb bones, and they see a very clear pattern. And females don't show the same pattern. So they often thought, well, maybe females weren't doing anything. And then when they looked at these arm bones, they realized, whoa, they were really big. They're even bigger than modern elite athletes. And the males are also big, but they, the patterns tend to be different, the same researchers have published work in other journals that have shown that the women look like not only are they big, but they're big in both arms, so both the left and the right. And so it's kind of repetitive motion that's going on for long periods of time with both arms being involved, something they don't see in the males. And this agrees with other studies that we've seen looking at gender differences in robusticity in the Americas, the Near East, the Far East. We've also seen these types of gender patterns.
And was this during a transition period to agriculture when this was happening?
This is around the time period. So the Neolithic starts about 7,000, 10,000 years ago. We see this transition around 10,000 years ago in the Levant and then various parts of the world where people are transitioned from being kind of hunting and foraging to starting to settle down into more agro-pastoral ways of living and having the economy. And so this is looking at bones from that time period all the way up until probably like 1,000 years ago, the medieval time period.
It's interesting. If you had only found, let's say, the bones, the forearm bones, how would you know that they were from a woman's skeleton and not a male skeleton? And could they have been mistaken in years gone by for being men's bones?
Well, that's an interesting question. So these skeletons were from bodies that had enough of the skeleton that they can determine age and sex. So they didn't include just humeri that were found by themselves. So they're full kind of bodies or bodies that are complete enough to determine biological sex. We're not able to determine biological sex with just one bone, like an arm bone. Even if a bone looks big, that's not indicative, oh, that it's a male or it's a female. You have to look at a lot of other indicators, mostly in the pelvis, that tell you that the morphology is most likely to be a biological female.
Mm-hmm. So I guess my point is we could have discovered bones from before that we thought were male bones were actually female bones if they didn't have the rest of the skeleton.
Absolutely. And often, you know, in the past, early biological anthropologists or kind of philosophers or people that were kind of a hobbyist interest in bones would pick up a bone and see it was really big and say, oh, this one's a male, or pick up a really small bone that's light and say, this must be a female. And so that was kind of some of the biases that were taken in, that women must be the weaker sex.
I think the biases are changing now that they're...
I think absolutely. I think there's a shift in the technology's ability to study these types of things and living and past humans and skeletons. But there's a lot more questions now related to women's biology, women's roles in the past, and trying to understand some of the behaviors that might be affecting bone morphology and health.
From this transition period from hunter-gathering societies to agricultural life, how would that have changed things for women and possibly the evolution of their bodies?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, we certainly know that the transition wasn't something that just happened overnight. It wasn't like, early human societies that were hunting and foraging said, okay, let's settle down now and start growing crops. It took a long time for these crops to be successful, for this new kind of way of transitioning to farming economies to do well and be successful. And so they probably still did a little bit of hunting. They would have done a lot of foraging at the same time. And females would have been instrumental at doing this. They not only would have been able to stay in one location, they still would have, of course, been having children, a lot of them, and would have been having perhaps a larger number of children than we would have had, breastfeeding these children for a large time. But they also would have been really instrumental in food production and in producing food and also kind of artisan craft things like pottery or textiles.
So where do you go with research? Now that you've published this about these bones, what's the next thing that you'd like to know?
Yeah, I think this study really is exciting because it starts to be an exciting time for us to start thinking about some of the other questions that would be really interesting to understand. You know, one of the things the study also shows is that while the upper arm bones are really strong, the lower limbs tend to show a lot of variability. There are some women that have really strong lower limbs, even stronger than modern athletes, even stronger than some of the men, and some that are not. So I'm really interested in why there's this variability. Is it possible that it relates to different labor roles, even within females or other groups? Maybe there's different ethnic groups or status groups, or maybe female changes in behavior change over the life course, not doing the same things when they're young than when they're old. And so trying to really understand some of these gender differences and division of roles and labor over time and how it intersects other variables along with gender, I think is really going to start being an exciting area of research.
So what other kinds of bones would you like to find?
Well, I'm really interested in continuing to look at earlier human populations, but trying to look at some of this variability more closely. So this study was really wonderful in giving us a diachronic perspective of changes over long periods of time. And I think what a lot of researchers want to do is to look at some of these populations more closely, try to look at the differences within groups, looking at the skeleton in different parts of the body, so not just bones that are mechanically loaded, like the arms, the legs, but try to look at how the bone is responding in other places, maybe to physiology or reproduction or diet and things like that, and seeing how some of these variables intersect with bone morphology and health.
Is there a bone collecting nirvana somewhere in the world that you'd like to get, you know, is a good place to search for this stuff?
Well, a lot
better
of times
than some
I
other
think,
place?
Yes, I think archaeologists are fairly lucky that we often have sites that we're able to study some of these things, and cemeteries that are excavated and museums that curate long-term collections. And I think one of the things that the study highlights is that we also have to have a good base of modern data on women's bone to compare a lot of these results to. So before, even when we were looking at female data, we didn't have kind of apples to compare it to. And the study, by taking modern samples and looking at the bone morphology, we're actually able to have more meaningful interpretations, I think, of archaeological data.
Can you just look at a bone like a person, like a regular person, and not wonder about its origin and, you know, everyday life? Or is that your business? I can't help myself.
That's kind of our business. I mean, I think certainly we always, when we look at these bones, do think about the fact that they're people. They're people's mothers, they're people's sisters, you know, they're people's wives, and they're doing things. And so I think the curiosity comes because even when we look at one isolated bone, we're very curious to find out what was it like to be this person, to be alive during their time period.
I guess it's the same thing about a dinosaur expert trying to eat a piece of chicken without thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sabrina Agarwal, Associate Professor of Anthropology at the University of California at Berkeley. She joined us via Skype. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to look at the HIV epidemic taking hold in the southern part of America, the African-American gay and bisexual populations in the southern part of America. It's really interesting new data coming out about that. We'll talk about it after the break. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. World AIDS Day is today, in case you didn't know that. It has been over 30 years since the disease was first documented in the United States. The first official CDC report about the AIDS epidemic came out in June of 1981. How I remember that. And those initial cases were in gay white men in big cities like New York and San Francisco. And since that time, new treatments, funding, and interventions have decreased the overall rate of new infections. But the latest CDC report shows that the highest concentration of HIV cases has shifted. Almost half of the people living with HIV reside in the South. And the hardest hit are African-American gay and bisexual men. The causes are a mix of complicated factors dealing with funding, access to health care, and stigma that still exists about the disease. One city in particular that has been hard hit is Jackson, Mississippi. My next guests are here to help us delve into the details of what is happening in Jackson and across the American South. Linda Villarosa is a journalist and director of the journalism program at the City College of New York. She has written about the epidemic in Jackson. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you very much.
Leonardo Mena is a director of the Center for HIV/AIDS Research, Education, and Policy at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and he's a clinician working in Jackson. Welcome, Dr. Mena, for taking time to be with us today. Thanks to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Linda, you've been covering AIDS and HIV almost since the beginning. Can you give us a brief trace of the disease, how it's become so concentrated in these communities in the South?
Well, what comes to mind is left behind. And so part of it is because so much of the attention was focused, like you were saying, in the North or in big cities and on white gay male populations. And so for various reasons, and over a long period of time, the disease has just gotten more concentrated in the South and really in Black, gay, and bisexual men.
Leandra, you've worked as a clinician in Jackson for 15 years. Tell us how you have seen the patterns of the disease change.
I think, you know, over the last you know, 15 years, we had gone through a process, you know, that had given us, you know, a better understanding of the HIV epidemic that is affecting, you know, our region. You know, Jackson, Mississippi is a state that has a relatively small population of 3 million people. Jackson is a moderate-sized city, but it's very representative of what's happening in many of the cities, in many of the southern states that have, you know, very similar kind of cultural, you know, and social context. And I think, you know, what we have learned is that we have gone from not knowing and not speaking about what we have to recognizing, you know, the challenges that we have ahead of us and how the number of HIV cases are increasing at a staggering, you know, rate, and how in an incredible way, you know, an incredible time that we're living, that you can argue that we have, you know, science has given us, you know, the tools to end the HIV epidemic. In many places in the South, we continue to see how those advances, I mean, have not really reached the population who is at risk.
Well, let's talk about it. Linda, why are they not getting what other people are getting?
Well, first, hi, Dr. Mena, and I love the work he's doing. And, you know, we must say this, that on the ground, there are a lot of people who really care about this issue and who are working very hard. But some of it is just, you know, has to do with transportation. Some of it has to do with other kind of...
Well, let's talk about it, for example, transportation.
So what I noticed was people had trouble getting around if they did not have a car. So in New York City, where we are, there's a, you know, wonderful subway system and buses. But in Jackson, the buses are really bad. It takes an hour. You might have to wait for a bus an hour and then another bus, another hour to get back. And so I noticed that transportation was a big thing. Also, many of the infrastructures are just really not that good. And so some of the clinics are not as good, not as strong as they should be. They don't have all of the latest, you know, equipment and things like that. But I think the infrastructure thing really struck me. The amount of money, you saw a lot of people who are very poor. So if you are poor, you're not as worried about HIV and even your own health because you're worried about survival. And I did see a lot of that where people were thinking first about, you know, how am I going to eat? How am I going to take care of myself? Not exactly how am I going to prevent HIV, which if I know about it.
Dr. Mena, if people do come to you, do you have the resources to treat them and help them?
I do. I mean, but again, you know, to a certain extent, you know, and as bad, you know, I think, you know, as better as things could be, and services that we provide, you know, in the city of Jackson could be. People who live in this metropolitan area of Jackson is somehow privileged. I mean, we have the University of Mississippi Medical Center that cares for approximately 30%, 40% of people who are HIV infected who are in care. But 55%, like Linda said, of the population in the city of Jackson, you know, live in rural areas. And for those individuals who are HIV infected, who live in rural areas, who don't have reliable transportation, getting access, you know, to quality care is quite a challenge. Not to mention that very often the only care that may be available to them sometimes may be, you know, in places where they may not necessarily feel comfortable in terms of their protection of their privacy, you know, because people who they know may work there. So that presents, you know, challenges. In terms of access, you know, to care, in the Jackson area, I mean, there are, you know, a number of providers that provide, you know, I think, you know, a state-of-the-art, you know, care for HIV, but in many of the rural areas, even access to HIV testing is fairly precarious.
So I guess, Linda, when you said, for example, people don't take the bus. It's a too long a bus ride. But from what I hear about the privacy issue, they're fearful of asking for a ride because of the stigma involved.
I remember there was a guy I was interviewing, and he was at a smaller city, maybe 2 hours east of Jackson. And so he was very ill by the time he found out he was HIV positive. And I said, you know, why didn't you know? Why didn't you get tested? And he said, I was afraid to go to the local hospital to get tested, which I knew they offered testing because my aunt worked there. Everybody knows my grandmother there. Everybody knows my mother there. And so I didn't want to go there. And that is a common problem.
Is that because it's a small town?
It was a small town.
But being in the South, does that add additional stressors also?
Yes, because the stigma is just higher there. It just is. And, you know, at once where you have people who are open and you have people who are loving and you have people who are really doing a lot of work in this area, you have other people who are just, they have high stigma against LGBT people, and it's very hard for them to talk about that. There's the church that makes it difficult. A lot of the guys I interviewed, I said, does the church, I know you grew up in the church, does the church give you some kind of solace? And they said, no, it's the opposite. The church is actually hostile. I've stopped going.
Wow. So there.
So if I can add, I think, you know, the stigma ties up, you know, in poverty, because the issue, you know, and the challenge is that many of these individuals who are, you know, at risk of HIV or who are infected with HIV, who, you know, live, you know, in poverty, are, you know, vulnerable, more vulnerable than other populations may be, you know, to a stigma. So they depend, you know, on their families. They depend on very often on the support of families and friends in order to just get by. And they are, you know, afraid of of how this support may be jeopardized by, you know, people learning they either, you know, that they either are HIV infected or that they may be, you know, gay.
Mm-hmm. I interviewed someone who was a college student. He had been a college student. But then when he came out to his family, they said, leave. And so he ended up in a homeless shelter, HIV positive in a homeless shelter. And so, like you're saying, Dr. Mena, it's like part of it is you're living already just close to the bone. And so then if you lose the support of your family because they don't accept who you are, that makes you vulnerable to all kinds of health problems and issues, including HIV.
I know there's an idea that the rate of infection has something to do with having a lot of partners, Dr. Mena, but it has to do with the prevalence of the virus in this community, right? The high level of virus here.
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of work has been done. Certainly, we know that a lot of work has been done trying to explain, you know, why the disparities in the HIV infection rates between, you know, African-Americans and whites. And one thing that has been proven is that a difference in behavior don't explain these changes. When you compare white men who are with men with black men who are with men, they, you know, even at similar behaviors, you know, that doesn't necessarily explain why blacks are much more likely to be infected with HIV than whites. And what seemed to explain, and I think, you know, Linda mentioned that at the very beginning, are things that have more to do with access to health services, with the background prevalence of HIV that may exist or exist in the African-American, you know, a gay community. So even if you have only one partner or two partners, which, you know, by all, you know, people would argue that that's not really having too many partners, the chances that that person may be, that one partner may be positive, is much more higher in networks of African-American men who are with men than what it may be in other sexual networks. So behavior really doesn't necessarily, you know, explain these disparities. Access to, you know, health insurance and to health services, so people can get tested for HIV or receive treatment for HIV, is a more important reason.
So let's talk about solutions. What's the solution or a solution here?
I think one of the solutions is really to support the people on the ground that are doing the work. And by support, I'm just going to, it's money. And so, there always needs to be more money. There needs to be more technical assistance.
Where would the money come from?
The money should come from our government, which is, I know, a ridiculous thing to say right now. But the money can also come from pharmaceutical companies. The money can come from nonprofit organizations. There just needs to be more money and support and technical support. But I think that one thing I learned from having spent time there is we also have to give acceptance and love. and to say, we understand what's going on. It's hard. We're not judging you. We're just trying to see, what can we do? How can we assist you, aid you, lend what we have, give what we have to you?
Dr. Mehta, let me talk about the money for just a bit with you. The South does not receive as much funding for HIV and AIDS as other parts of the country, considering how many people are living with the disease in that area. And why is that? And is it possible to change that?
Yes. I mean, I think it is possible, and you're correct. I mean, a part of it, you know, a lot of the care of HIV is funded through the federal government, thanks to the Ryan White Care Act that Congress, you know, reauthorizes every 5 years and provides, you know, care for, is a payer of last resource for the care of HIV. It cares probably for almost half of individuals who are HIV infected in the United States. And what happened is that the formula, you know, that is used for allocation of HIV resources takes into consideration the total number of cases of HIV. So if you think about that, that includes a lot of individuals who may no longer be living with HIV or be living anymore. So that the formula is skewed towards, you know, cities or states like New York City or California, or some of the larger cities in California and the Midwest, affects, you know, negatively impacts the smaller cities in the South that have a much more kind of a, if you will, younger epidemic. But I think the urgency and the needs of the South are being recognized. I think that, as I say, you know, at the beginning, you know, luckily we have the tools to really end the HIV epidemic. What we need is the investment to make sure that these tools reach the population that are at the greatest needs. And if we don't figure it out as a community, I think the challenge that we have is that, you know, in few years, I mean, HIV can become mainly a problem of the South.
Hmm. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. That's interesting that you say that. You mean it just would be isolated as a, mostly in the South, is what you're saying, Dr. Mehta.
Right.
Wow. So it would be known as a problem in the South. Now, I know that you at the University of Mississippi Medical Center run an LGBT clinic, a successful one, I'm assuming. Are there lessons you can learn from that experience?
Well, certainly. You know, we don't run the clinic at the University of Mississippi. The clinic is actually run by a community-based organization, my brother's Keeper, which is a community-based organization with whom we partner to build this clinic. And primarily is because we wanted to create a space where the community, you know, felt welcome, you know, felt included, where people, you know, didn't feel, you know, judged by, you know, who they were or, you know, the choices, you know, or who they were, you know, as individuals, or infections that they had, or where they seek, you know, prevention or treatment of these things. So I think, you know, that clinic opened its doors in February 2013. And since then, what we have seen is an incredible, you know, increasing awareness among healthcare providers and healthcare systems, both in our city, in our state, and even in our region, of the need to build, you know, healthcare, you know, systems that are culturally competent, who are capable of delivering quality care for gender and sexual minorities that are affected by so many health disparities, including HIV, you know, and sexually transmitted infections.
So the conversation has begun in larger communities.
I agree.
Yeah.
And I also like my brother's keeper isn't just about HIV/AIDS. It's about healthcare disparities, and it's about all kinds of healthcare. So when you go there, you don't necessarily, I mean, people in the know it's an HIV/AIDS clinic or an LGBT clinic, but there are other people getting treated for other things there. And so it feels more community and less very specific about this one disease.
Well, we've run out of time. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Linda Villarosa, journalist and director of the journalism program at the City College of New York. Leandro Mehta is director of the Center for HIV/AIDS Research, Education, and Policy at the University of Mississippi Medical Center, and a clinician working in Jackson. Thank you both for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
After the break, we talked earlier this hour about the evolution of human muscle. But up next, a look at synthetic muscles. ones robots could use. And guess what? They're at least as twice as strong as human muscles. What could we use them for? And you'll find out what they're made out of. Kind of interesting and surprising. So stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We've all seen construction equipment like backhoes and jackhammers powered by hydraulic pumps and pistons, and they do the heavy work. But it turns out that the intricate folds of origami, which can transform the plainest piece of paper into a 3D work of art, origami can also turn a lowly piece of plastic sheeting into an artificial muscle capable of lifting something 1,000 times its own weight. Ooh, the robotic muscle consists of an origami skeleton. It's surrounded by a plastic or a fabric skin, and it's filled with air or water. You change the air or water pressure, and the muscle can contract or even clench objects in its grip. Interesting stuff. Here to tell us about it is Danielle Roos. She is director of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT in Cambridge. Her work appears in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences this week. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much.
And we have photos and videos of these things in action. They are really something to look at. They are up at our website at sciencefriday.com/origami. You got to see how they move. Tell us, Dr. Roos, you built these muscles with inspiration from origami. Tell us what interests you about origami and as a roboticist.
So those videos are really quite magical. I love looking at them all the time myself. So I am interested in making robots, and robots are made of bodies and of brains that control the bodies. For every kind of capability we need in a machine, we need to create a robot that has the body capable to deliver on that capability and the brain capable to control the body. Now, traditionally, robots are made as complex systems. So they consist of many parts that require significant human development effort and expertise to put them together. But in nature, things happen in much more elegant ways. And in particular, folding in nature occurs to create a wide spectrum of complex structures, morphofunctional structures. And this is where origami robots comes in, because inspired by the folding processes in nature, we can invent a new approach to making complex and beautiful machines using the ancient art of origami.
So you take the origami sort of as the backbone, and you sheath it in some plastic, and I'm looking on our website at one of your origami robots working, and then you suck the air out, and so it curls up, right, as if it's a finger in some cases, just simply by the air pressure difference.
Exactly, and what it does can be controlled by the shape of the origami structure we put inside. And so, for instance, we can make these machines contract in one dimension, like linear muscles. We can achieve two-dimensional contraction. We can achieve bending, rotation, twisting. We can achieve a variety of motions just using this very simple principle you described so well, I have to say.
Thank you. Another project I know you've worked on is a robotic pill that you can swallow and have it unfold in your stomach. Whoa, tell us about that.
So we've been working with origami in many different applications. And the origami pill came because we were inspired to think about the future of medicine, where we might imagine a time when surgeries happen without incisions, without pain, without the risk of infections. And for that kind of vision, we created a robotic pill. So we made a little origami robot that we packaged in an ice pill. You can swallow the ice pill. And when the pill gets into your stomach, the ice melts and the origami robot unfolds. And now, because the origami robot has a little magnet embedded in it, we can use an external magnetic field to control the location and the movement of this robot. And we can do a lot of interesting things with this technology. For example, we can remove foreign objects that get accidentally swallowed and lodged inside your stomach. And you might ask, who swallows foreign objects?
I'm a parent. And, well, I don't ask that question. So I know the answer.
Well, so this robot can actually pull out the button batteries that get lodged in the stomach coating and can puncture holes in the muscle tissue very fast. Hmm. And with this little antidote origami pill, you can pull that that battery out of the stomach coating very fast and very, very smoothly. You can also use these robots to patch wounds inside the body, to deliver medicine, to take tissue samples. So there are many, many different applications we can envision for this type of device.
So in the origami that you do, and of course it is paper folding into different shapes, bringing this to a little more 21st century idea, would it be possible to 3D print them instead of fold them around? Or does that ruin it?
Well, actually, you can fabricate the basic structure that is the sheet from which you create origami in many different ways. You can use laser cutters, you can use 3D printers, you can use paper and scissors, you can use low-tech. You can make these robots in a variety of ways. And in fact, they are so easy and inexpensive to create, they have the possibility of becoming pervasive. They have the possibility of becoming very useful tools for education. They mm-hmm. could become toys, or they could become tools for surgeons and in other professions.
Now, I understand that you want to take some of these techniques and build an elephant. Am I getting that right?
Yes. So in our paper, we have actually shown how to make one muscle using these techniques. And now we want to compose these muscles to create big human-scale machines that can work side by side with humans in factories or in homes. And we picked the elephant because the elephant is such an interesting creature. So we are actually not going to make a real life-size elephant. We're going to make a baby elephant that is human-sized. But we're very interested in the trunk of the elephant. We're very interested in the ability of these soft yet strong muscles to do delicate operations and strong operations at the same time. And if you watch an elephant use its trunk, it's amazing how that trunk can pick up a peanut. And it can also knock over a competitor.
Mm-hmm. And so I would imagine, looking at the videos and seeing what materials you're making, you're using to make your construction, it's probably a lot cheaper to make than something with hydraulics and pistons and things like that.
So we were very surprised to see that such a low-cost manufacturing process can lead to actuators, to muscles that have such a wide range of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. So where would you like to go? What's your next step here? What's your ultimate...
For this works?
Yes.
Well, with the strong muscles, I would really love to make robots that can pack and unpack groceries for me.
Oh, really?
And maybe move things around and tidy up my space. Yeah, in fact, if you think about packing and unpacking groceries, it's actually very challenging because you have to handle grapes and broccoli at the same time as heavy cartons of milk, for example. And so having the softness of a robot hand, you are able to pick up the broccoli and the grapes, which do not have a regular shape, because the softness enables these robot hands to adapt to anything they grasp. On the other hand, having the strength really allows this robot to pick up something heavy like a milk carton.
Wow, I'm looking forward to putting one of these together myself, being the tinkerer that I am. So. Hurry up and get it ready.
Well, we have recipes.
You have recipes?
We have recipes for making them. Where would
I find those recipes?
They are published along with our paper.
Okay. Well, we have a link up on our website, and we have some wonderful photos and videos of these things in action, and they're really cool to look at our website at sciencefriday.com/origami. Thank you, Dr. Roos, for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much.
Daniela Roos is director of the Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Lab at MIT. And it's that time of the year again. No, I'm not talking about the holiday season. It's the annual Flame Challenge competition, which a group of scientists are asked to explain one simple concept, like the original idea, what is a flame? The catch is that the judges are all approximately 11 years old. They're third graders. It's a test of the scientists' communication skills. And we have the originator of the Flame Challenge, an expert science communicator himself, in the studio with us today to announce publicly for the first time this year's Flame Challenge question. Welcome back to the show, Alan Alda.
Hi, Ira. How are you?
Nice to have you. All right.
Okay, so this year the kids have been asking this question or questions very much like it since we started 7 years ago. And the question is, what is climate?
Wow. A lot of people get that wrong, don't they?
And even if you got it right, how do you explain it so that an 11-year-old is engaged by your answer and it's an accurate answer and gives them both something they didn't know and the desire to know more?
Well, just to illustrate how difficult that answer is, we went to some of the best science communicators that we know, and that's our staff.
Yeah.
And we asked them how they would explain what it is, and here's what they had to say.
Okay, hold on. Let me think for a second.
I mean, the climate is the weather every single day of the year, over many years. So if it rains one day, that's the weather. But if it rains every day in May, that's the climate.
It's like one Lego block versus the whole Lego building, or like the Statue of Liberty built out of Legos. Weather is one Lego, whereas climate is the whole structure.
Is it going to rain today? Is it going to be 60 degrees and I can wear my shorts? Or is it going to be a pants day? That's weather. So I guess, like, do I live in a pants region or a shorts region would be, like, something about the climate of where I live? Does that make any sense?
It's like the environment of the... I don't want to say air. Yeah, the environment of the air. This is terrible. I can't say anymore. It's getting worse.
You can see how difficult that is.
It is. That's a wonderful springboard for the Flame Challenge, because it really challenges scientists in every field to see if they can come up with an answer that hits the mark, that has snap to it, that doesn't use jargon, that appeals to a real 11-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a real challenge. It's hard to do.
This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International, talking with Alan Alda about this year's Flame Challenge. And you're looking for scientists, right?
Yeah.
To join in.
Yeah. You know, over the years, in these 7 years we've been doing it.
Years already?
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
That we've had, I guess, a couple of 100,000 kids from all over the world and a lot of different countries judging this contest. And we didn't realize what a boon it would be to kids in an educational way. But the whole idea always was to help scientists have the experience of taking on this, what seems like an easy task. Oh, I'm going to tell an 11-year-old what this is. It turns out to be very difficult, and it's deeply instructive if you can actually tackle it and achieve something. So the more scientists we've had a few thousand scientists over the years. I'd like to get a few thousand in one lump now. So we're making a real push to get more scientists involved.
We have a few listening, I think. So tell us how, if you're a scientist, how you would join up.
Well, a good idea is to go to flamechallenge.org, and you can register on December 18th. Both schools can register their kids and scientists can register to send in an entry. But before that, there are warm-up exercises you can do. We're really trying to give some more help in this process. For instance, we have webinars, three webinars that are going to start in a couple of weeks. And one is, what is an 11-year-old? So we
that's a tough question.
we have interviews with 11-year-olds, and we try to get the scientist in a position to sort of frame in their mind who mm-hmm. they're talking to, mm-hmm. what's going on in that mm-hmm. mind. Because if you don't have that as a starting yeah. point, you're just sort of blasting it out there, and you have a lower chance of getting into their head with it. And one of our previous winners will be on the video giving some tips and that kind of thing. Then the next one is a webinar devoted to a game that will help you rid yourself of jargon.
Oh.
I think it's called the Jargon Police.
And could use those around here.
And the third video is dedicated to the idea of making it snap. Mm. How can you say it so it really clicks in my head? Yeah. And we have, limits on the amount of time you have. You have only a few hundred words or a few minutes. I forget the exact. I have to look at the website myself. Yeah. We've changed the rules a couple
and
of times.
And a website again? Give out the website?
Yeah. Flame Challenge. That's easy. Flamechallenge.org.
Oh, that's easy to remember.
And another warm-up exercise we have, which is really catching on, I think, on social media, which is to say something about your work in science, just as a warm-up, not about answering what is climate, but just about your work in science. Say it in a haiku and see if you can engage people with some aspect of your work. And if you do that on, say, Twitter, include a link, if you will, to flamechallenge.org, because you're going to appeal to other scientists to get on board and take part in that competition. Even if it's just the haiku part of it, that may draw them into the Flame Challenge.
All right. We'll see if we can help launch the Flame Challenge as we have every year.
You've been so great with
that.
Thank you.
We're very happy to
help you. Our first winner who made that spectacular video only knew about this because he heard about it in a podcast from Science Friday.
And there you have it. What a great curtain call for that. Alan Alda. Alan Alda. You know who Alan Alda is. The Flame Challenge this year at flamechallenge.org. BJ Lederman composed our theme music. If you missed any part of the program, you'd like to hear it again. As Alan says, listen to our podcast. And now, if you ask Amazon Echo or Google I won't say it. I don't want them all to turn on at the same time. You can listen to Science Friday. Also, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Thank you, Alan.
Thank you, Ira.
Good luck with the Flame Challenge this year. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flato in New York.